You are listening to an audio recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. The event, held on Tuesday, November 9th, 2010, was titled Thinking Outside the Box, How Can U.S. Service Providers Benefit from the CHORUS FTA? The speakers were John Patrick Goyer, Laura Lane, and Anissa Witten.
Good morning, and welcome to the Korea Economic Institute. My name is Troy Stangerum, and I'm the Director of Congressional Affairs and Trade. Laura Lane is stuck in traffic, but should be here momentarily, but we thought we'd go ahead and start. As you know, right now, the United States and Korea are in Seoul trying to wrap up a few minor details on the FTA. Interestingly, or fortunately, services is not on those agenda items, to any of our knowledges, but hopefully they'll have those results in the next day or two. But what I think is interesting about the services sector is that it's if you saw the poster coming in, it's sort of, I think, amorphous to a lot of people. What is services? You know, is it express shipping? Is it financial transactions? You know, it's not sort of something like, a piece of machinery or a cup that you can just put your hand on and touch oftentimes. So we wanted to take and sort of look, because when you do the modeling on FTAs, it's all based on goods. You don't model services. So we wanted to try and talk about what the benefits for services are and how this FTA impacts that. I'll briefly go through. You have more detailed bios in front of you, but just briefly. To my left is John Goyer, who is the Vice President of the Coalition of Services Industries, a U.S.-based membership association which promotes the liberalization of international trade and investment in services. In this capacity, he works with the coalition's members and U.S. trade negotiators to ensure that the business's international trade objectives are reflected in bilateral, regional, and multilateral trade agreements. He also serves as a member of the U.S. Government Industry Trade Advisory Committee, which advises the U.S. government on information technology, electronic commerce, and telecommunications issues. Laura Lane, who will be here shortly, is the Managing Director and the Head of International Government Affairs for Citigroup. She currently serves as a cleared advisor to the U.S. government on international trade and investment issues. Before joining Citi, she was the Vice President of Global Public Policy at Time Warner. In her government career, she was responsible for bilateral trade affairs with the Middle Eastern and Mediterranean countries during her time at USTR. She also negotiated market access commitments on trade and services with China as part of the session. Going through your bio real quick. As I was saying, she also negotiated market access commitments and services with China as part of the accession to the WTO and served as the U.S. negotiator for the WTO financial services negotiations. She also served in the U.S. Foreign Service from 1990 to 1997. To my right is Anissa Witten, who is the Vice President of International Affairs and Trade Policy for the Motion Picture Association of America. She works with federal government agencies and Congress to reduce foreign trade barriers and improve protection of intellectual property in foreign markets for the U.S. motion picture, television, programming, and home video industries. Prior to joining the Motion Picture Association, she worked in the State Department's Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs as state's expert in trade and services, representing the department at the WTO and free trade negotiations. Her other policy portfolios included government procurement, trade capacity building, cultural diversity, and temporary entry. And with that, I will turn it over to John.
Well, thanks very much, Troy. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me here this morning. Troy briefly described what the Coalition of Service Industries is, and for those of you that aren't already familiar with the organization, we have a broad array of services industries represented within our organization, including banking, insurance and other financial services, audiovisual services, telecommunications, IT services, express delivery, retailing, professional services, and others. Those industries and other service industries collectively account for about 3/4 of the American economy. The sector that we call services, that huge umbrella, also employs about 80% of the American workforce. The U.S. is the largest and most competitive services exporter in the world. Last year, our services exports were $483 billion. And we enjoyed a $150 billion services trade surplus. Those numbers are actually down from their height in 2008, but poised to recover this year. An even more important indicator of U.S. services trade is the sales by affiliates in foreign markets. Many services, by their nature, or as a result of regulation, require companies to have a physical presence in a foreign market in order to deliver services. And U.S. sales of services through those channels were $1.1 trillion in 2008. So our services exports are huge, but they're far from their potential. And in large part, that is because of the prevalence of barriers to services trade and investment. And if we can address those barriers by means of FTAs like CORUS, I think that there is huge potential for growth in our trade and therefore in U.S. employment and economic growth and recovery. The U.S. economy and indeed the world economy is increasingly dependent on services. Services contribute to every aspect of a country's economy. They're a fundamental part of the economic infrastructure and can help determine a country's success in exporting manufactured goods, agricultural output, as well as other services. And neglecting the role of services will undercut the goals of more competitive manufacturing and agriculture industries. As we said in a press statement that we issued during a visit to Geneva to take the pulse at the WTO a couple weeks ago, quote, without services, neither agricultural nor manufactured goods can be transported, financed, insured, delivered, advertised, or sold. In short, commerce, and with it growth, stops. For all these reasons, CSI strongly supports the CORUS FTA. Korea is a critical market for U.S. services and has huge growth potential. With a population of 48 million and a GDP estimated to reach just under $1 trillion this year by IMF reckoning, the size and potential of that market, combined with the prevalence of barriers to U.S. services there, make this the most commercially significant of all recent FTAs. I was fortunate enough to visit Korea last month as part of a delegation that the U.S. Chamber organized. Laura was on the same trip. A couple others in this room were there. And one can't help but be struck by the sense of vibrancy and dynamism in that market and a real sense of optimism about their economic future. And in our discussions with various officials, one of the interesting things about the services dimension of the agreement was Korea's interest in locking in services reforms simply to bolster their own competitiveness. And I think that shows that there's a clear recognition in Korea of the importance of services to their overall competitiveness. Korea is the third largest U.S. services export market in Asia, behind Japan, slightly behind China. Our cross-border exports of services to Korea were $12.6 billion last year, while imports were $6.4 billion. So we had a services trade surplus with Korea of a little over $6 billion. In terms of the actual services that are being traded between the U.S. and Korea, it's a diverse picture. The largest category of U.S. exports fall into a category that the Bureau of Economic Analysis calls other private services, which is a huge range of different services that include financial services, insurance, telecommunications services, IT services, management consulting, professional services like legal and accounting and other types of services. In addition, royalties and license fees are important exports, which include services like broadcasting, franchise fees, trademarks, and the like. Travel and transportation services are also important categories of U.S.-Korea services trade. The CORUS FTA contains important and groundbreaking provisions that will address market access barriers and regulatory obstacles faced by U.S. service providers in that market. It will facilitate both cross-border trade and services and direct investment in service industries in Korea. The increased manufacturing and agriculture trade between the U.S. and Korea will benefit the U.S. services business that support those sectors. The CORUS FTA has a number of horizontal benefits that I'll touch on and then briefly talk about the specific benefits for several key service sectors. First of all, the CORUS FTA was negotiated on what is called a negative list basis, which means that all services at the outset of the negotiation are presumed to be open, and the exceptions to that have to be specifically listed in annexes to the agreement. And that helps ensure that you get comprehensive coverage in the services sector, and that the exceptions and the limitations are very narrow and specific in scope. The negative list approach also has the virtue of ensuring that as new services are developed, especially in growth areas like computer IT services, new and previously unforeseen services are captured and bound within the agreement. The core SFTA also includes strong investor protections, which are critical to promoting greater participation of U.S. service providers in that market. The core SFTA also contains strong transparency obligations. Services tend to be highly regulated, and thus transparency in domestic regulation is crucial, especially in markets like Korea, where opaque and discriminatory regulatory practices have in the past been problems for many of our companies. The Korea FTA also expands access to U.S. service providers to the Korean government procurement market. Korea is already a member of the WTO government procurement agreement, but the FTA will provide access beyond what is in those WTO obligations. The CORUS FTA opens up the market to a broad range of key U.S. service sectors, and I'll just run through kind of briefly here. Telecommunications. There are a number of important commitments in that sector, including the right of U.S. companies to own 100% of a Korean telecommunications provider, which is up from the current limitation of 49%. It also ensures non-discriminatory access to the Korean public telecommunications network and contains strong obligations for telecommunications suppliers, cost-oriented interconnection, competitive safeguards, resale, and important transparency obligations with respect to the telecom sector, including a commitment that the regulator has no financial stake or interest in a supplier of telecommunications services. On computer and related services, because of the negative list approach that I mentioned, that sector is bound and captured in the agreement, particularly important as that's such a U.S. strong suit. In electronic commerce, the CORUS FTA ensures non-discriminatory treatment of digital products and that Korea will not impose customs duties, or fees, or other charges on digital products transmitted electronically. Korea also agreed to duty-free treatment for digital products imported on physical media, CDs. In express delivery services, the strong growth in U.S.-Korea trade has contributed to growth in express delivery services between our two countries, particularly as the volume of high value-added, high-tech types of goods, which tend to be shipped via express delivery, has increased. The CORUS FTA includes an appropriate definition of express delivery services. It includes important customs clearance provisions. It clarifies the existing Korean postal law and embraces principles for ensuring a level playing field. These agreements really do make a difference. In its submission to USTR on CORUS last year, for example, UPS noted that it found that its export volume had increased by 28% to countries with which the United States had recently ratified free trade agreements. In insurance, there are important provisions there, including the full range of establishment rights, the ability to set up joint ventures or wholly owned subsidiaries or branches, depending on a company's preferred business model. The agreement also permits a broad range of services provided on a cross-border basis. And in addition to those market access benefits, there are important gains in the regulatory area specific to insurance. In legal services, the agreement opens Korea for the first time to foreign legal advisory services, and Korea has also committed to phase in additional liberalization that will permit foreign lawyers to more freely associate with their Korean counterparts and offer a broader range of services. And there's other sectors that have seen benefits as a result of this agreement as well. Architectural and engineering services, for example, energy services, among others. Briefly here, looking at the competitive landscape, the U.S. and Korea signed this agreement over 3 years ago. Since then, Korea has concluded free trade agreements with the EU, India, Peru. It had already signed FTAs with Chile, Singapore, the European Free Trade Association countries, and ASEAN. And negotiations are underway with Australia, Canada, Mexico, New Zealand, and a few others. The U.S. will be left further and further behind as Korea concludes one trade agreement after another with U.S. competitors. Let's briefly look at the EU agreement as an example. I cited a number of benefits for different U.S. service industries, but a quick reading of the EU-Korea trade agreement shows that many of those same agreements will accrue to European services providers once that agreement goes into effect. The two agreements aren't carbon copies. There are important differences between the EU and the U.S. agreements with Korea, but the bottom line is that EU companies will enjoy access and guarantees that U.S. companies will not. For example, they'll get the same telecom benefits that the U.S. negotiated. They will see benefits in express delivery services. The EU agreement contains measures for liberalization and guarantees in financial services, in legal services. If you take a look at the comparative trade and investment relationship, EU-Korea versus U.S.-Korea, you'll see that flows of goods between the EU and Korea exceed those between the U.S. and Korea. On services trade, U.S.-Korea trade is slightly greater than EU-Korea trade, about $19 billion versus $17 billion. But in terms of investment, the EU is fairly far ahead of the United States, both in terms of annual flows of investment as well as the cumulative stock of investment. So against the backdrop of already larger trade and investment flows, the EU would be in a position to build on its existing very strong commercial ties with Korea. Inaction on our part, therefore, is the same as moving backward when so many other countries are pursuing FTAs with Korea. The CORAS provisions were hard won. These were some major negotiating achievements on the part of the United States. Services are a U.S. strong suit. Our services exports have grown sharply in recent years and have shown a fair degree of resilience even through the financial downturn. Increasing trade and services will strengthen U.S. economic growth, generate demand for highly skilled and well-paid American workers, and raise living standards in the United States. Therefore, not surprisingly, CSI strongly recommends the expeditious passage of this agreement. Not only would CORAS increase the competitiveness of U.S. producers in Korea, but it sets the standards for opening markets in the region and will ensure that the U.S. remains a critical part of economic integration in Asia. I think more broadly, passage of this agreement would send a very strong signal about U.S. trade intentions and U.S. trade leadership, both in the Asia-Pacific and globally. I mentioned our trip to Geneva a couple of weeks ago, where there were a lot of inquiries about the CORAS FTA and where was this thing going. And interestingly, one WTO official remarked that in terms of helping to prod Doha forward, one of the best signals that the United States could send would be to pass the CORAS FTA. We couldn't agree more. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Next, we'll have Anissa.
Hi. Thanks very much for coming this morning. I work at the Motion Picture Association of America. MPAA represents the six largest producers and distributors of film and entertainment in the world. Our member companies are Paramount, Sony, Warner Brothers, Disney, Fox, and Universal Studios. Our industry, our motion picture industry is probably one of the world's most competitive film industries. We support 2.4 million U.S. jobs and contribute over $140 billion in U.S. wages in 2008. While MPA represents the six largest producers and distributors of film and entertainment, our industry is actually exceptionally decentralized. There are 115,000 businesses across the United States involved in the motion picture industry. 80% of these are small, medium-sized businesses employing fewer than 10 people, and one quarter of those businesses are sole proprietorships. While many of these small, medium-sized businesses aren't necessarily exporting overseas, they're providing very valuable inputs to film and television programming that relies on overseas markets for sustainability and viability. Our member companies, I guess about 46% of their revenue is derived from overseas markets. We export to 150 countries around the world, and we're one of the few industries that consistently generates a positive balance of trade, and that surplus was $11.7 billion in 2008. We have a very strong interest in the sustainability of international markets, and we're a very strong supporter of global trade. Looking at the South Korean market, South Korea is both an importer and an exporter of entertainment product. I think it was maybe 99, 2000, a Chinese journalist coined the phrase Hallyu, meaning Korean wave, and that was to denote the popularity of Korean entertainment media around the world, but in particular, Southeast Asia and China. Korea, as I said, is a major exporter of entertainment content, but it's also an importer. It has historically been a top five market for the U.S. motion picture industry, and it was in 2009 the 17th largest market for our member companies. I think in 2009, the number one film was a Korean film. It's Tidal Wave, but its number three top box office grossing film in 2009 was Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. And when you look at the top 10 films for 2009, we have six that are Korean and four that are U.S. films. So clearly the U.S. industry is competitive in the Korean market. We could do better. One of the challenges we have in the Korean market is that Korea maintains a screen quota of 73 days, and that means that Korean theaters must screen Korean films 73 days of the year on each of its screens. I'll talk about that screen quota a little bit later, but clearly Korea has a very competitive film industry, and this screen quota is antiquated. It was put into place at a time when Korea wasn't, when they are still trying to develop their domestic industry. That industry is now very well developed and highly competitive. Korea's television market, cable penetration in Korea is about 70%. It makes it the seventh largest cable market in the world. Its satellite penetration is still fairly low, but again, its cable market is, the cable penetration is exceptionally high. The TV market in Korea is subject to significant content restrictions that affect my industry. There are restrictions on the number of foreign channels that cable and satellite providers may transmit. There are also limitations on foreign programming that cable and satellite operators can retransmit, as well as foreign investment limitations in the television market. Korea also maintains a web of discriminatory content quotas for cable and satellite. There's a 70% foreign content limitation for movie channels and a 60% foreign content limitation for animation. And there are other content limitations depending on genre that are currently working in that sector. And there are also onerous broadcasting restrictions operating in the Korean market. The home entertainment market in Korea, unfortunately, was decimated a few years ago because of online piracy. The fact of the matter is, between 1999 and 2009, because Korea has such a deep broadband penetration, it's able to transmit very large files, movie files, across the internet, and that happens to be a way that Koreans like to consume content. Unfortunately, the home entertainment market was just decimated. They went from about 40,000 DVD rental stores to about just under 2,000, just to sort of give you an indication of what's happening in that sector of the market. Now, on the upside, the online market in Korea is growing. Korea, largely, I think, because of the FTA, has taken major steps to improve the protection of intellectual property online. In fact, very impressive steps. And in 2009, we've sort of seen this incredible growth of the legitimate online market for content in Korea. It's actually the third largest in the world at this point. There was a joint venture with Disney and a Korean company that launched in 2009 to promote legitimate sales of both foreign and local films. And there have also been a couple other new online ventures that have emerged in 2010 to promote Korean and international content, and those are legitimate. So the Korea FTA, MPAA is a huge supporter of the Korea FTA. And in fact, I think that I can speak for the U.S. motion picture and film television industry broadly. That means that this is not just the industry and the studios that I represent, but the independent filmmakers, as well as the organized labor that is that works in our industry. Those are the Directors Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the writers, producers, and so forth. And largely that's because of the impressive intellectual property protections that Korea has taken, but it's also a recognition that the motion picture industry relies on overseas markets for its viability because the money, the revenue that we generate from overseas markets goes back to productions back here in the U.S., and those are U.S. jobs. In 2006, as sort of a precondition for launching the FTA, Korea agreed to half its screen quota. So a few minutes ago, I mentioned that there was Korea maintained a 73-day screen quota for domestic films, but that was originally 146 days, which meant that's 40% of the year. That's a significant chunk of time. So as a good faith measure to negotiate the FTA, Korea agreed to half that screen quota. And I think that's had a real significant impact on the competitiveness of the U.S. motion picture industry in the Korean market. Also, as a precondition for the FTA, Korea agreed to eliminate this discriminatory measure, which is where foreign films had to undergo a review period before entering the market. It could sometimes take up to 2 weeks, which would significantly delay entry into theaters and so forth. So that's been eliminated. And again, I think that was a demonstration of good faith on the part of the Korean government and their interest and I think recognition that these sort of were outdated measures and also acknowledging that their industry is very competitive and doesn't need to rely on such measures anymore. Going forward, as I mentioned, we still have significant limitations in the television market, and the Korea FTA addresses these. The Korea FTA substantially relaxes the content quotas for both animation and film, and it obligates Korea to increase the quota that's applicable to single markets or a single economy in Korea. So right now there are limitations of what one economy can export into Korea, and that has been increased or will be increased when the Korea FTA goes into force. And the FTA also improves our ability to invest in the broadcast sector. And the Korean government, I guess over a three-year phase-in period, will increase the ability of foreign investment in the broadcast sector to 100%. But we're not going to be able to realize these benefits until the FTA enters into force. So we are huge supporters. And I also feel like I need to make a little bit of a plug for the agreement more broadly. I mean, I know today we're here talking about the services and investment obligations, but for our industry, we have equities and interests across several chapters of the agreement. As John mentioned, the electronic commerce chapter is critical. Those zero duties are hugely helpful, and the national treatment in MFN for online commerce is very important to our industry because the online market in Korea has so much potential, and it's a place where consumers go to consume content. And we have an interest in the goods chapter and ensuring that there are zero tariffs. And of course, the IPR chapter is hugely important to our industry because once we enter into a market, we need to ensure that our content is protected from theft and that we have remedies available to us if our intellectual property is stolen. And again, the benefits of that will also help Korean producers, but we need to see this agreement pass if we're going to be able to realize some of these additional benefits.
Thank you. Laura?
All right, I'll pick it up from there. We're in the middle of a continuing recession. What's the best way to get out of it? It's to engage. It's to begin exporting even more. It's to be creating vibrance and growth in our economy. And it's also by tapping into the growth that we see in other regions and finding market opportunities for our companies to access the 95% of the consumers that are outside the United States. John wasn't kidding. We got off the plane, and you could feel the intensity in the air. You could feel it all across Asia, but in Korea particularly. There is a lot of growth and dynamism there, and U.S. companies need to be able to compete in that market on the same terms as all of our competitors. John mentioned it. There's lots of countries that have already negotiated fantastic deals with the Korean government. They've lowered the tariffs so that they pay zero on their goods going in, and we can continue to pay 5, 10, 20, 30%. Why not pass a free trade agreement that eliminates all those tariffs, that gets us that competitive balance so that we can go into that market on the same terms and conditions? Seems like a no-brainer, and I don't think you need to think outside the box or inside the box. You just need to get going and get the agreement passed. Why is it so important for Citi? We've gone through a financial crisis, and what we've seen is that a lot of countries are concerned. They need to maintain the growth levels. Some of them, though, are taking very protectionist actions. They're locking down capital, they're locking down liquidity, and they're thinking about ways to put in place protectionist barriers to keep goods and services out from competitors, but make their own domestic industry competitive. We need to be showing the way forward in terms of showing that those kinds of barriers and free flows of goods and services are the way forward. The Korea Free Trade Agreement does that. Why is Citi such a big backer of it? Because financial services is one of those industry sectors that often is saddled with a lot of protectionist measures. You see through the course of this crisis and in many ways around the world an existing condition where there's a lot of efforts by governments to prop up their national banks to make it a little bit more difficult for foreign service providers of financial services to come into the market and compete. But through the Korea Free Trade Agreement, the Korean government agreed to provide market access, which means we can come in and operate on the same terms and conditions, set up our branches, set up our subsidiaries, operate under the same kinds of rules that the Korean banks do. We get provided national treatment. We can provide the same goods and services that the Korean banks do, and we can engage in vibrant competition that at the end of the day serves our clients better and serves American and Korean consumers better. Because at the end of the day, through good competition, I think the Korean as well as the U.S. financial institutions grow stronger. Now, Citi operates in 140 countries around the world. We represent or provide banking services to about 98% of the Fortune 500 companies. We also serve as the banker to small and medium-sized companies who are the suppliers to many of these large companies operating around the globe. When you ask an American small and medium-sized company, or even the biggest, they want to go with the banks that they know, the banks that they're working with in their local market, as well as the ones that are supporting them around the globe. Oftentimes, American exporters want to go with American financial institutions. Therefore, we want to see opportunities for our clients in the Korean market because they see opportunities there. We're the bankers to them. We want to see them be able to expand their export base in the Korean market. So from our client perspective, when we look at this agreement, it's again one of those that just provides so many competitive advantages for U.S. exporters. If you look at the good side of this agreement, 95% of the tariffs go down over 3 years to zero. The vast majority of the rest of the tariffs on goods are eliminated after 10 years. For the agricultural sector, it's the same. About 85% are eliminated almost immediately upon implementation of the agreement, and then the rest, the remaining 15%, are phased out over 15 years. So you've got a time horizon where you can realistically see that tariffs are going to go to zero, either in the immediate near term or in a fixed and definite longer term time horizon in which investment plans can be made and companies can be expanding their export operations into the Korean market and be able to compete on the same terms and conditions as they've gotten in some of these other agreements. So from our client perspective, it's a tremendous opportunity. They grow their export base, we grow the financial services that we are able to provide to them in that market. The agreement is also very important in terms of the principles and the commitments it makes with respect to some of the issues that are the subject of discussion in the G20. In the G20 discussions, you've had a lot of talk about how to improve regulatory oversight for cross-border activities, for how to better manage risk in the international system. What's stunning about the Free Trade Agreement, which was concluded now over 3 years ago, before this crisis even started, is that the Koreans and the U.S. agreed to enhance transparency and greater regulatory sharing of information in the area of financial services. services. So you have mechanisms for promoting greater dialogue between U.S. and Korean government officials in terms of oversight of the financial services system, which is tremendous. You also have a lot of important disciplines in there with respect to the cross-border flow of data. This is one of those groundbreaking commitments that was included in the free trade agreement that you have nowhere else. It allows for the free flow of data so that the data that underpins all the trade investment flows can move with the transactions. There isn't any data locked down or any kind of black box that regulators can't see into, because the data flows back and forth so the regulators can have oversight over it in either jurisdiction as it moves. This is critically important because as trade and investment flows continue on a cross-border basis, you need to have the data that goes along with it, moving with it. And the commitments that are included in this agreement are so important because you do now have certain countries around the world that are looking at ways to lock down that capital. That runs completely counter to efforts by the G20 to get greater oversight over cross-border risks. And so this is one of those groundbreaking commitments that we're hoping actually can be built on in terms of negotiations with other countries around the region. When I look at the costs of delay, John touched on them, I think it's really important to reinforce. We've taken a 3-year timeout on trade, and I think that there have been significant implications, and there have been market shares that have been lost. In a number of the markets where agreements have been negotiated and the U.S. is missing in action, and or our clients, our exporters, have to go into those markets at competitive disadvantages because they're paying higher tariffs or they have certain restrictions on their abilities that their competitors don't have. We need to get back in the game. Today, the European Parliament approved the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. If you do a comparison between U.S. financials or the financial services industry or any of the services sectors, there's pretty much comparable provision of services between our country and the European Union. You could do the same for goods. You could do the same for agriculture. And so when a Korean consumer in the current economic environment is faced with purchasing goods and services from one entity versus another, cost is often going to come into play, or the kinds of services that can be provided are going to come into play. Right now, the European providers of those products and services will have a competitive advantage over U.S. institutions, because that agreement's going to come into effect before ours does. I think the U.S. can catch up, and I have complete faith that U.S. companies will be able to get back in the game, but we can't have too much of a delay. And so I'm very, very hopeful that at this G20 meeting, and I hope on November 11th when President Obama and President Lee meet, that they will be able to have found a way forward on the outstanding issues that remain with respect to beef and autos, so we can get back in the game and get back in terms of building our market share in the Korean market. It is a tremendously important market for us. It's a tremendously important market for us in a region where you have a lot of opportunity. The Chinese are very active in the region and are doing deals left and right with a lot of countries, again, at great competitive advantage to Chinese service providers, and that shouldn't be lost on anyone in the room. We need to have a U.S. leadership in the region demonstrating the standards for high standard free trade agreements with good protections for intellectual property, with good protections for investment, with good protections and good transparency provisions included in those agreements, so that across the Asia region, as we grow in those markets, we've got high standards for trade rather than some of the alternatives that have been negotiated there. So if you look at it from almost every level, from financial services, which are the fundamental infrastructure for promoting greater trade and investment, from our client base in terms of the goods, the services, the ag products that we're helping to make, move, buy, and sell, in terms of the costs of delay, it's one of these agreements that from every facet that you look at, needs to be passed and needs to be passed soon. So thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, we've talked about a wide range of services and in some cases even goods. So with that in mind, I'd like to open the floor up to questions now. We have mics on either side, so if you'd please wait for the microphone to come to you and then state your name and affiliation. They were that good? No questions?
No, it's because there's no question. We should pass it. That's why. No.
Peter?
Peter Whitney, I'm retired FSO. I teach at three universities. I'm curious about that 73-day screen quota. They have lowered it to that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to stay? They're not going any further in the agreement?
Not in the FTA. I mean, they halved it. And that was a huge accomplishment and a huge concession, I think, by the government of Korea. That being said, we'll continue working outside of the FTA to encourage them to lower it even further.
Does any country have a better quota than 73? Does the European Union get a?
A lot of countries don't have quotas, period.
Well, I've been in countries that have, like Argentina and so forth. That's not just trying to make a comparison.
Does anybody have a more significant one?
Yeah, anybody negotiate a more liberal one with South Korea? All the agreements.
No. The EU tends to be very protective when it comes to audiovisual services, so that issue wasn't touched upon.
Can I ask a question, sort of tangentially to this, or come back?
Go ahead.
Okay. Bernanke's expanding the money supply like crazy, and there's a tremendous reaction against that around the world. Are banks then going to penalize our banks because of that in Korea and elsewhere? And how do the Koreans feel about this huge quantitative easing?
I think that's going to be, I wish I was one of the staffers in the room that got to watch some of the exchanges between the Brazilians and the Germans and the Koreans. I expect in their capacity as hosts will try to be keeping everyone and the discussion civil. In terms of whether I think that there's going to be any discriminatory retaliation against the U.S. Institutions, I don't expect that at all. I think that what we've seen across the Asia-Pacific region is that a lot of these countries, Korea included, are looking at ways to grow their market, and they're doing it in partnership with U.S. institutions, working through U.S. financial capabilities when it suits their interests. I don't see them taking that kind of cut off their nose despite their face kind of action. I think there's tremendous concerns about whether the U.S. is going to be able to meaningfully address its deficit and the implications that deficit has, and whether additional monetary policy tools are going to be needed actions are going to be taken that could be problematic for a lot of the emerging market countries. I think in the interests of continued global trade and investment, I'm hopeful that there'll be a good multilateral agreement reached on ways forward so that one action, and any action that any particular country takes, isn't at the expense of another, or it can be minimized as much as possible. I'm hopeful that on the trade side, for example, we'll be showing a leadership way forward, and that may help in terms of generating greater growth. And it's a challenging time, challenging environment. There's limited policy tools that can be effective. And so we'll see what they come out with at the G20.
John, I have in the back here.
Thanks. Kelsey Snell from National Journal. I've been speaking with people on the good side of this quite a bit, and several of them have said that, including Ford, that this FTA kind of represents a template or a kind of modeling tool for other free trade agreements going forward, and I'm wondering if there's any sort of parity there on the services side.
Gosh, there's tremendous.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things about the services dimension of this agreement is that we don't have an auto issue and we don't have a beef issue. We actually like the agreement a great deal. And as I tried to outline, there are benefits across a broad range of service sectors, all of which are U.S. strong suits, all of which are large U.S. employers, and all of which have great scope for growth, whether it's telecommunications or IT services or express delivery or financial services or insurance or the professions, retailing, what have you. We do extremely well in this agreement, and that's why there's such broad support across the entire spectrum of services industries. So can it be improved moving forward? I'm sure that it could be, but it's certainly a model for moving forward on other trade agreements in the Asia Pacific and elsewhere.
Can I give you specific examples? No other agreement has a commitment in it that, for example, for express delivery, that constrains the postal monopoly and forces them to have to play fair. No other agreement has data processing commitments with respect to the ability to move data on a cross-border basis with protections for that movement, since it's so vitally important to the underpinning of trade and investment flows. No other agreement, it's the first agreement ever that has covered digital cinema-related issues. You didn't have any agreement to this day that covered those kinds of issues and had anti-camcording provisions in it, which is a huge issue for the entertainment industry. You have, I'm trying to go through like the whole list, a lot of the e-commerce chapter provisions. We started working on them in previous free trade agreements, but this agreement really does capture the concept of digital goods and provides it the intellectual property protections as well as the zero duty treatment so that it goes in. You can never have, in other words, a government, or the Korean government in this case, going forward and trying to impose after-the-fact tariffs on it. You've got in the financial services chapter specifically, the first time ever to have a committee set up that looks at addressing some of these regulatory issues, that has regular meetings occurring between the Korean government and the U.S. government in the area of financial services. That's first ever. Even on the auto side, I would note you have very groundbreaking provisions that weren't negotiated in any other agreement before, that admittedly, I know the negotiations are still going on and there's improvements that need to be made, but there's an exceptionally strong agreement that was negotiated like none other before that has a committee that meets whenever there are any kind of non-tariff barriers related to the movement of cars or auto goods that meets to assess whether any kind of barriers are being put in place that inhibit the flow of that trade that go against the spirit of the agreement. There's also a special provision that claws back any concessions that the U.S. made if we do find that the Korean government is playing games with some of the auto concessions that they've made. But what's fantastic about the agreement is, as I've gone through each of these areas, there's constant dialogue. And I think that when you have that regular dialogue and discussion going on about some of these non-tariff barriers to trade, you have a greater chance of resolving them than if you had no dialogue going on between the governments. And I think it's through that regular dialogue that you often make so much progress in terms of making advances in increasing the trade volumes between the two countries. There's a completely longer list, but those are just a few of them from the services side, because it is one of those gold standard agreements that really tackled issues that hadn't been tackled before, and we had a willing partner in Korea, given the strong alliance we already have, in trying to set a new standard for agreements going forward.
Yes.
Joe Schatz with Congressional Quarterly. Just following up on that a bit, I was curious, you all mentioned the investment protections in the trade deal. I guess more broadly, I mean, how has the issue of investment protection become a bigger deal in sort of modern trade agreements that, relative to market access issues than it used to be? Or is, I mean, how important are the investment protections in this deal as opposed to the market access issue?
Well, they're both important. The thing about services is that so many services are delivered by means of a direct investment in the marketplace rather than cross-border. Now, both are extremely significant. In the case of Korea, our cross-border exports are $12.5 billion. Our sales by affiliates are about $11 billion. It's kind of interesting there because usually the sales by affiliates far exceed the cross-border sales. But in any event, because many services simply require you to have a physical presence in order to serve your customers and clients in that market. You need those kind of investment protections. So they are extremely important, very important in the service sector.
If I can pick up from John as well, you know, another part of the agreement that I think often is overlooked is everybody looks at, okay, what can we, you know, take from the U.S. and export out to Korea? The other part of this, though, is the great partnerships we've struck with a lot of Korean companies and the inward investment that has occurred here. A lot of folks, you know, are so focused on where the jobs are being created. Well, Korean companies are coming into the United States and creating a lot of high-paying, good-quality jobs. You look at states like Georgia, Alabama, you've got investment from Korean companies in those markets. The Hyundai plant in Georgia has been a tremendous benefit to that economy in terms of making sure that Georgians have, you know, the jobs in that industry sector. You've also got companies like Samsung, for example, that went into the San Antonio area and set up a new plant. And not only did Samsung create new jobs in the San Antonio area, but then it created opportunities for Applied Materials, which supplies a lot of the inputs into the Samsung products that they provide. You created a little ripple effect there where you had more jobs created in that Texas community by virtue of the inward investment decisions that the Korean company made going into that market. That is something that shouldn't be underestimated. There's a lot of synergies between U.S. companies on the tech side and the entertainment side in particular, where between U.S. and Korean partnerships, they're creating all new products and services and creating good jobs here in the United States. And those are just a couple of them. We've got a good list of other partnerships between U.S. and Korean companies that have been job creating here in the United States, but that's an important aspect to consider as well in terms of the inward investment.
Yeah, Bill. Bill Cooper with the Congressional Research Service. Because services, the barriers are primarily regulatory barriers, I was curious to what degree the concessions that Korea would make to the U.S. would be applied on an MFN basis. In other words, you know, on the legal opening up of representative offices or in telecommunications, the ownership. Would it be just U.S. Legal firms that would be able to take advantage of that, or would that apply to other foreign investors?
That's a good question, Bill. In some cases, it's going to be both, because it's pretty hard to weed out one foreign service supplier versus another in terms of their regulatory treatment. So I think that a lot of these concessions will be applied on an MFN basis. And I could try offline to give you kind of a breakdown of that. I don't have it right off the top here, but I mean that's certainly an issue, because you know you can apply a tariff on a good from one country but not another, and it just does not work that same way in services, particularly when it is a matter of is the service being provided on cross-border and therefore subject to one set of regulatory constraints versus by means of direct investment, and therefore perhaps different rules and regulations would apply.
I guess the reason why I asked it is that as you mentioned, I think all of you mentioned that the EU-Korea FTA is very similar to the CORUS FTA in terms of coverage and even to some extent the concessions that Korea makes. If the EU-Korea FTA should go into force before the CORUS FTA, wouldn't U.S. Suppliers benefit from the concessions that Korea has made in the Korea-EU FTA? The only reason why I'm not trying a gotcha here. I'm trying to understand.
No, actually, and it's maybe, it's maybe not. For example, okay, so Mick Giordano.
In one area where that's not the case. I mean, it is the case. I think maybe a lot of the professional services, and maybe some of the infrastructure services, but it definitely is not the case for audiovisual services. I mean, the EU historically does not include audiovisual services or television services in trade agreements. They have this huge blanket cultural carve-out. So those inroads that we achieved in the Korea FTA, we're not going to benefit from because the EU FTA goes into force. And in fact, some of the content quotas in Korea have to deal with single country source. So we need that single country source to be elevated. That the only place we're going to get that is in the U.S.-Korea FTA.
And I was going to add to that. So you have to think of how the trade and investment flows go. These are global supply chains. And, you know, you've got a lot of partnerships created. So, let me take an ag example from the pork industry, okay, because pigs are pigs, right? The U.S., Nick Giordano from the pork producers, he's so passionate about this. You know, they're looking at the tremendous concessions for being able to export pork products into the Korean market, but the Europeans are going to get a jump on that. And a lot of the financial services that go in supporting some of their, the transportation shipment of their products, the transportation services they use, they tend to go with their suppliers of those services. And so with the growth in their exports goes the growth of the financial services, the transportation services, the refrigeration services, all the suppliers that go along with that growth. If the Europeans get a jump on it, maybe it's Deutsche Bank doing those commodity derivatives. Maybe it's DHL doing that chilled pork in fast. Or, you know, you can see the ripple effects of all of that. So maybe in some instances, like on the services side, we wouldn't see effective discrimination, but the supply chains that are already in place for moving those products and services, we aren't going to be a part of that. And if their volumes decrease, our volumes decrease. We've seen that already, for example, in the case of the Columbia Agreement, where, you know, wheat and soy products have gone to other markets and therefore gone to other service suppliers, that because we're not part of that game right now. Same would apply in the Korean context. And so you have to think about it in terms of those supply chains and, you know, where those partnerships are created in terms of expanding growth. So,
and in the interest of full pork disclosure, the EU already exports more pork to Korea than we do, so it's almost a double whammy. Yes, Meredith.
I think that you didn't get in the Korea FTA 3 years ago that you're asking for in your sectors in the TPP negotiations, things that as we get tend to perfect these things, we'll get more possible.
I mean, for us, certainly. I mean, we in the TPP, we'll be looking to ensure that there aren't sort of that blanket of content quotas that were bound in the Korea FTA. What I can say with the Korea FTA, when you find them, they're not going up. So it gives us a sense of stability and predictability in the Korean market. When we look to the TPP, we would hope not to have any of those discriminatory quotas, and in fact, we'd probably be going back to some of the FTAs that we've negotiated with some of the four TPP partners and try to roll back some of the some of the Annex 1 provisions that were inscribed into the agreements.
In terms of the TPP, Citi serves as one of the co-chairs, and one of the elements that we're trying to, and all the members of the coalition are trying to advance in the TPP, is this concept of global supply chains, because a lot of the agreements are negotiated on a unidimensional basis, and they don't take into account the movement that occurs in these supply chains between countries. And so what we're trying to do is get a 21st century agreement that focuses on those supply chain issues, that makes the trade simpler, less burdensome, and makes it so that you can do things more flexibly between countries rather than having to do it kind of by a connect the dot way. It's hard to explain. But when you look at the global supply chains, you see what companies need in order to be able to build their products, move their products, and get them to their customers. And we're trying to get the chapters in each of the agreements to work more closely together so that the financial services chapter naturally works with the tariff reductions that are occurring so that you don't run into any particular bottleneck within the supply chain. And there's a really good paper that the TPP Coalition has put up, and I think it's on the TPP Coalition website, that kind of outlines the supply chain concept and how we're taking the gold standards that have been set in the Korea agreement and trying to knit them together in ways that work in a regional setting. So,
and similar to that, there's also a discussion underway in the TPP context on regulatory coherence, where you have disparate regulatory regimes both in goods and services. And how can you, you know, not harmonize necessarily, but how can you kind of rationalize those systems so that companies operating within the region don't have to deal with completely different sets of regulatory standards and regulatory requirements? And part of that, I think, is simply increasing the transparency, looking at how we can improve the transparency provisions and models in the existing agreement to help kind of streamline and rationalize that whole process. So that would be important if we're able in some way to improve on the existing model. I think particularly for services providers, that would be a great improvement.
It's just like the trade facilitation stuff, like, you know, you only have one set of paperwork to fill out within the TPP countries to move a product around the region. If you're hedging foreign exchange risks or you're, you know, developing a derivatives product, it works in a regional context so that there aren't different rules applied in different ways. You know, those are the kind of examples of just facilitating the trade so that you're eliminating inefficiencies or redundancies and finding ways to make sure, okay, everybody's got the same objective, that they want to make sure the products that are coming in are safe, are, you know, what they say on their container, and, you know, that they've gone through all the proper procedures coming in and out of ports or being provided to the customers, but that companies operating in each market don't have to do it in different ways to meet the same objective. And I think that's one of the groundbreaking efforts underway in the TPP is really to address that. Because when you look at the, once you eliminate all the tariffs, what you've got left is kind of these regulatory or non-tariff barrier issues that really you need to find some common approaches to in order to facilitate, you know, the trade and investment flows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're operating regionally, that's what you need, and companies are not operating strictly on a bilateral basis with individual countries. You know, you could be doing business with Singapore and with Malaysia and with Vietnam or other TPP countries, for example, but it tends not to be, you know, separate siloed relationships.
I mean, that's certainly the case for the motion picture industry. For any one film, you may have post-production occurring in several different countries, and particularly in the TPP markets. I mean, you have amazing regional competence and skill in the post-production work, and we're going to probably tap New Zealand and maybe Weta Studios in one place, and then you tap Malaysia and some of its animatronics, and then you can, it's just, you know, you want to be able to tap those different markets, and you can use that through online commerce. You can do that by actually sending the 35-millimeter film to another market to have input done there. But any way to ease that, the flow of that commerce, that's, I mean, that would be
so
a huge step forward.
What would the TPP potentially do that just get us more regional?
Yeah, anyway, as John and Laura were saying, that you can regionalize those disciplines and get them so that they're coherent and you're not having to deal with different regulatory procedures or limitations for different countries, and it'll just make it so much easier. I mean, our business people, it just makes their lives so much easier. They don't have to go back to their trade association to say, well, what's happening in this market? I need to get my film over here to get this input from New Zealand, and I'm running into this barrier, this tariff, and, you know, if to make that more seamless, that will help a business.
All right, well, if there are no additional questions, please join me in thanking our panel for a very excellent discussion this morning.